And now, back to brainstorming with Billy.
It turns the brains into guacamole.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Welcome back. This is Bill Frank, and you're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain here on KKZZ, Positive Talk Radio for Ventura and Santa Barbara Counties. Every show has a theme, but before we get today's theme, just a reminder, please take the poll on my website, brainstormingonline.com. I ask a simple multiple choice question. Who had a greater influence on U.S. history? Was it Martin Luther King or Cesar Chavez? You can cast your vote at my website, brainstormingonline.com. That's brainstorming, S-T-O-R-M-I-N, online.com. I'll announce the overall results of the poll on Thursday's show. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is the past, the present, and the future. Each of my guests is discussing a topic that pertains to the past, the present, or the future. My next guest is the niece of Downton Abbey creator Julian Fellowes. She'll discuss the series and the times 100 years ago from her book, The World of Downton Abbey. And if you want to call in and ask a question, or if you want to join in the conversation, you can call us at 639-0008. Jessica Fellowes is an author and a freelance journalist. Her latest book is titled The World of Downton Abbey, based on the hit PBS series. Formerly, she was the deputy editor of Country Life. Jessica has also been a columnist for the London paper. Her columns have formed the basis of her book Mud and the City, Do's and Don'ts for the Townies in the Country. She writes for the Daily Telegraph, the Telegraph Weekly, Psychologies, and The Lady. Joining us from London. Hi, Jessica. How are you this evening?
Hello. Very well, thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Well, thank you for taking time away from your tea to join us here to talk about your beautiful book, The World of Downton Abbey. Now, I just want to start with some of the contradictions that we have between 1912 and today. Those of us living today, we think we're experiencing rapid change, but in reality, a century ago, there was even more rapid change than there is today.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are people living in the Edwardian era, England, we're less used to rapid change than we are today. Just think about it. We had electrification. Automobiles were just coming into play. Downton Abbey talks in the series about the introduction of the telephone. The airplane was starting to make its presence known, mostly as a fighter in World War I. We had women's suffrage was a big issue then, because back in 1912, the women didn't have the vote. The growing gap between the aristocracy and the masses. And a story that I just love to tell is when the Dowager Countess is talking with the cousin for the very first time, and he says, oh, I'll be able to do this job of running Downton Abbey on the weekend. And she looks at him quizzically and says, the weekend? What's a weekend? 100 years ago, there was no such thing as a weekend. So give us an idea of the impact that all of these changes were having on English society in the period from 1912 to 1919.
Well, I mean, there's no sort of one-line answer to that, because it's just as we feel the impact of technology, you know, rippling through every layer of society and at home and at work, so did they. And I think what was extraordinary for them was that they were not only trying to take on board quite unbelievable ideas, as they seemed to them, you know, the idea that you could communicate with somebody through a mouthpiece, who somebody who was not even in the same house, you know, let alone the same room, or maybe in a different country. They had to get their heads around that. They had to get their heads around, you know, switching lights on rather than lighting candles, you know, all of those things. But then there was what those things led to was a different change in the way that they worked. So you you know, for example, the mechanization of things meant that the cook no longer had to produce everything from scratch. So that changed the way that she ran her kitchen. It changed what servants could expect to do. So, I mean, that was just the beginning from the lower ranks, as it were, and that spread all the way up. But that impact was speeded up by the First World War. There were a lot of things that were happening anyway, but the war acted as a catalyst. It meant that medical improvements have to be made very fast, technological improvements have to be made very fast. As you talked about, aeroplanes and air flight, all of that meant, the war meant that they had to really escalate those changes. And that was why the end of the decade, you know, 1919, felt as different from 1912, almost as, for them, almost as we do now. I mean, it was just a whole different period.
It certainly was. My guest is Jessica Fellows. We're talking about her book, The World of Downton Abbey. And Jessica, one of the great scenes from the PBS series about the telephone is that people had to learn how to answer the telephone. I mean, we take that for granted today. But the reality is there's this great scene with Mr. Carson, who is the butler of the house, trying to figure out how he is going to respond when the telephone rings. That was that new to them at that time in 1912.
Well, of course, but I mean, if you think about when email first came in, you know, we all have to think a little bit about how, what sort of language we used on those. You know, did we talk formally in an email like a letter, or were we going to be informal? We have to kind of find our way through it. So it's exactly the same for Carson. He feels he needs to emphasize how important he is, but at the same time, he's not the actual master of the house, so you have to be careful not to overstep the line. So, it would have been a very tricky question for everybody.
It was. And the whole issue of society and where you were in society was also going through a major upheaval. The war accelerated all of that. But talk to us about people in service. I mean, the story about Downton Abbey is as much about the servants in the household as the members of the household itself.
Yeah, absolutely.
Talk to us. What was it like to be in service in 1912? What did that mean to the people who were serving in those roles?
Well, I mean, of course, it did depend on the house you were in. But I think what we have to get our head around now that is quite difficult for us to comprehend, perhaps, about the attitude, the psychology of someone in service 100 years ago, was that they didn't see it as a demeaning thing. They were very proud of their work. You were in a job, it was probably something you had expected to do. For a lot of people, women particularly, who lived in rural outposts, get a job in a house meant you weren't working on a farm, you know, so it was work was hard, yes, but you were in a house, you were given meals, you were given cloth for your uniform, and you were paid, and you had holiday time, and, you know, and it was regular work, and well looked after, and you were educated in the sense that you saw another way of life. When you lived on a, you know, in a farm, as you can imagine, you'd be up very early, you'd be working in all sorts of weather conditions, you know, it was, some years would be very good because the harvest was good and others would be terrible. So working in a big house was something to really aspire to. Plus, you got promoted. If you were good at your job, you could be like Daisy, the kitchen maid. You could be promoted to Anna, the head housemaid, or you might choose to become a lady's maid like Miss O'Brien. William, the footman, his father is ecstatic when he gets the job because he means he has a chance of eventually working his way up to being a butler like Carson. And they would earn those promotions often through moving around from house to house, just as we would, you know, change jobs in order to improve our situation or salary deal or whatever. So I think, you know, we think of someone working as a servant and we think that's a terrible and demeaning job, but that was not how they saw it. But that did begin to change slightly. Well, quite a lot, actually, during the First World War, when other opportunities arose, when people who perhaps had expected to spend a life on a farm suddenly found themselves fighting in France, and they then saw another whole way of life. When they came back, they couldn't adjust back to the normal life easily, and so they started to look for different options. And also, women were given the opportunity to work during the First World War in order to keep the home front going while the men were away, and they were reluctant to give up those positions of independence when the men returned. So that was what escalated a lot of the society's changes. And that's when the servants started to say, maybe this isn't necessarily what I want to do. I've been brought up to expect this is what my parents think is great, but I've actually got another idea of what I want to do.
It's hard.
That's what we see happening in Downton Abbey.
It's hard to keep them down on the farm once they've seen Paris. My guest is Jessica Fellows. We're talking about her book, The World of Downton Abbey. And in the PBS series and in your book, the house itself is an actual character. Now, Downton Abbey, as we see it in the PBS film, is actually played by Highclere Castle, which is a 6,000-acre estate. It's owned by the Earl of Carnarvon, whose great-grandfather was there when they opened up King Tut's tomb in 1922 with the explorer Howard Carter. So how and why was Highclere Castle cast in the role of Downton Abbey? Because it's such a beautiful home.
It's an amazing house, yes. Well, Julian, the creator of Downton Abbey, in fact, knew the house already. He had wanted it to be the house for Gosford Park, which was the film that he wrote, which Robert Altman directed, and Julian won his Oscar for. But Robert Altman felt it wasn't in quite the right geographical location, so it didn't happen. So when it came to Downton Abbey, Julian took the executive producer and the production designer to Highclere Castle, and they loved it. But he said, in much the same way that a woman is not ever going to choose the first dress she sees, but needs to go around 30 more shops before she decides that, in fact, it will be the first dress she buys after all. They went around the whole of the UK, looked at about another 60 houses, and then they came back to Highclere Castle.
And it's a
what they liked about it is that it's very different from the houses that we see in the sort of Jane Austen miniseries. It was a real break from the past, and it's such an imposing character in itself, and so that was why it was exactly right for the show.
Well, it certainly is, and that's really what captivated me into watching the show and staying with it as long as I have. My guest is Jessica Fellows. Now, Jessica, it's interesting that 100 years later, things aren't that different today than they were in Lord Grantham's day 100 years ago. The owners of Highclere Castle are what we would call asset-rich and cash-poor. Lady Fiona Carnarvon estimates that it will take about $18 million in the next few years just to do renovations around the place. So they rent out the castle for weddings, for movies and TV shoots, just like you're doing. They even charge admission to visit. 100 years ago, that wasn't the solution, though. They handled it in quite a different way. 100 years ago, what was the norm if you were a rich earl, such as Grantham, and you needed cash to keep your house going and to preserve the family estate?
Well, I mean, at that time, they didn't even consider the option of renting the house out. I mean, that just didn't even enter their brain. So what he did, I mean, in fact, the Earl of Carnarvon at Highclere Castle at the time also did, was that they cast their eye about for a rich heiress to marry. Now, at that time, as I'm sure you probably know, there was a sort of wave of rich young American heiresses coming over called Buccaneers. They were coming over largely because they had a lot of money, but they didn't have much class. And it's actually harder to get into the sort of higher society echelons of, you know, sort of Virginia than it was to get into the high society echelons of London. So the ambitious mothers brought their young, pretty daughters over to England. Well, if I can get my daughter a title, then surely no one can turn us down for tea in Virginia when we get back home. So that was what a lot of them did. Anyway, so that was what happened to the Earl of Carnarvon at exactly the same time. He married a woman called Almina Womb, who was supposed to be and almost certainly was the illegitimate daughter of a Rothschild. So she rescued Highclere Castle, and that was what paid for Howard Carter's trip to King Tut's tomb. And in the same way, we have Cora marrying Lord Grantham. So they married as an arrangement. And then in the story, as the Downton Abbey story goes, they fell in love in the first year of their marriage. So it all turned up.
Right. So their relationship mellowed into what we traditionally think of a marriage today. But how did that relationship impact the relationship between Lady Grantham and the Dowager Countess, her mother-in-law?
Well, it was kind of an unusual one that, in the way that Julian has scripted it, because how Julian scripted Dowager Countess is that she is a very old-fashioned aristocrat who believes that class is what matters more than anything else. So although she is happy that Cora's money has saved her beloved Downton Abbey, she still would rather have taken somebody with less money but more class. So that was what made things very difficult between them. It didn't really ever really resolve itself. It wasn't helped by the fact that Lady Grantham failed to produce a son, because in those days, any what was termed a defect, i.e. someone being born a girl rather than a boy, was considered to be the fault of the mother. It was never the fault of the father. And of course, any mother-in-law, by default, has always managed to produce a son, so she's always got one over on you.
Right, that is true. My guest is Jessica Fellows, author of the book The World of Downton Abbey, The Rivalry and Romance Revealed. It is the companion piece to the Masterpiece Theater, a PBS series that is going on right now. Jessica, what do you want readers to take away from reading The World of Downton Abbey?
I think what I'd really like is to, I mean, obviously you would enjoy the great richness of the book, which I think the publishers worked incredibly hard to make sure it reflects the series. So there's lots to enjoy there in terms of looking at the images. But what I'd really love everybody to take away is to sort of understand that although we look back on people in history, we tend to kind of patronise them slightly, I think. I think we tend to box them and think, well, if they were a servant, they must have looked and behaved and felt this way. And if they were an aristocrat, they would have felt and behaved this way. And I think in the book, because I draw a lot on real-life counterparts to the characters in the series and try to establish the context of what life really was like at that time, I hope we understand that they were just as complicated, emotional, messy human beings in 1912 as we are in 2012.
And I think you do a very good job in the book. My guest has been Jessica Fellows, author of the book, The World of Downton Abbey, the companion piece to the Masterpiece Theater series of the same name. Jessica, if people want to learn more about you, learn more about the book, where would you direct them to go on the internet?
You can check me out on Twitter, if that's your kind of thing, at Jessica Fellows, or you can go to my website, which is jessicafellows.com.
That is great. Jessica, it has been a delight. Thank you so much for taking time away from your dinner to be with us here today on Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We'll talk to you down the road.
Thank you.